So we're going to be starting chapter Chaf Beis 22 in Tanya. Let me just show you the paging numbering in there. It's very strange. So okay. So let me just—we haven't learned Tanya for a while. We took a break over the summer and we did other things. Okay, so let's give a bit of an introduction over here. So the truth is that Tanya is, the first part of Tanya is the 53 chapters, but in the 53 chapters, there's sections, right? And this particular section really started on chapter 18 and it's going till chapter 25. It's one of the hardest sections in Tanya. But I'll try to give a little bit of a synopsis before we start. Give me 1 second. Chapter 22. Okay, so let's just refresh our memories here. Or give a synopsis for those who are joining us. Okay, so Tanya is based on the struggle between the godly soul and the animal soul, nefesh l'kis nefesh habamis, right? And the way actually it speaks about it in the very beginning of Tanya, in the introduction, he says it's based on the pasuk in the Chumash that says that the Torah and the observance of Torah, learning of Torah and so on, is very korov. Korov, it's hard actually to translate the word korov, but accessible. Some will say easy, it's not really easy. It means it's accessible, it's very accessible, right? Because no one actually thinks it's easy, but it's accessible. All right? And he says he's going to explain in different ways. So, essentially, the point of Tanya is the concept of the Beinoni. The Beinoni is not the Tzaddik. The Tzaddik is someone who's in full control of his animal soul, and including the intellect and the emotion of the animal soul. A Beinoni is not. So, therefore, he wrote the Sefer called the Sefer of a Beinoni. Beinoni means an average person. It's not exactly an average person, but it's the aspiring to be that average person. In other words, the Tanya is not even aspiring to be a tzaddik. Although he does talk about the Tanya, the idea of having tzaddik moments, but that's another discussion. But then he talks about aspiring to be a Beinoni. A Beinoni is someone who cannot transform his or her animal soul, which means the struggle will still be there, the temptation will still be there, but the Beinoni is someone who can be in control, have the choice to be in control of his, what we call levushim. Levushim means the garments of the neshama, which is machshava, dibur, amaisa, thought, speech, and action. Right? Now, the beginning of Tanya, the way he explained how this works, doesn't just work. The animal soul is a very impulsive, emotional, and strong soul. So it's not just that simple about being in control and saying no to everything that the animal soul says, obviously. But, which means, because a Beinoni really is someone that, as he defines earlier on, when a person's reached the goal of being a Beinoni, it means a person who's in full control of his thought, speech, and action, and never does anything that's an avera, a transgression, never does anything that's ungodly. Bit of a difference there. In other words, even something that's technically permissible, like eating, for example, but if he eats indulgently, or not for the sake of heaven, that's already considered to be part of the world of Klippa, right? That's the ultimate Beinoni. So the Tanya is about taking steps towards that, getting in control of our thought, speech, and action. Now, it is difficult. So in the beginning of Tanya, he said, the way it comes through a lot of davening. And the purpose of the davening is that the davening should allow us to develop a love of Hashem, right? And a fear of Hashem. That's what davening is. Davening is a time to nurture. So there's a Tanya on the bottom shelf. There's a chitas there, so there's a Tanya. Yeah. Right? So davening is the time that we nurture or we develop, because Tanya is about working with the animal soul. Tanya is about contemplating the greatness of Hashem. When you contemplate the greatness of Hashem, you conjure up an emotion of love and fear of Hashem. And that motivates us that we, after davening, when we're so fired up with the Ava and Yira of Hashem, we then are able to control the Nefesh HaBamis. Okay, that was the first part. Then he said that the truth is not everyone can do that, right? Because not everyone can develop a full-blown emotion of love. People talk about loving Hashem, but do we really love Hashem, right? I think everyone in this room would say, I love God, but do we really love God? Love God, loving God means that when you really love someone, you don't do anything that's contrary to him, right? So I think I've told a story. There was a chassid in Lubavitch, his name was David Horodoka. David Horodoka was such a big chassid, he used to daven for hours every day. And one time the Rebbe Rashab walked into the yeshiva and there was about 30 bachrim who were davening longer than the minyan. And he walked into the room and they all stood to attention except for two bachrim. One of them was Reb David Horodoka, who didn't notice the Rebbe Rashab come in. He was so engrossed, so lost in his tefillah, he didn't even notice that the Rebbe Rashab was there. And the Rebbe Rashab said that for him and his friend, the whole Tom Chetzmim and the Holy Shiva was worth it. That's paid off all the expenses, the rest is just profit, right? So on his deathbed, they asked Reb David Horodoka, just before he died, they said, someone said to Reb David Horodoka, "Nu Reb David," in Yiddish he said, "De grecht avas Hashem," did you reach love of Hashem? Did you really reach that level of love of Hashem? So he didn't want to acknowledge that it was true, out of humility or out of whatever it was, but he couldn't deny it either. So he said, "No, a kitzel gitan, a little bit of a tickle I had, something, okay." That's Reb David Horodoka, but we're not even anywhere close to being even on the journey of Reb David Horodoka, okay? So Tanya says that developing a real full-blown emotional love for Hashem, like a real romance with God, is not in everyone's capability. So the next strategy he gives, I'm just summarizing all the way till now. The next strategy he gives is, we can develop what's called, if we learn a lot, we really understand the depth of Hashem, and we really understand the mitzvahs and the Torah and so on and so forth, we can develop what he calls an intellectual love, right? Intellectual love means that when you think about the importance of something, even though you don't fully feel it, but in your mind at least you come to a conclusion that this is something worth being attracted to. Maybe you don't feel fully fledged love in the heart, but at least in the mind there's an attraction towards that, right? A lot of times even in life we think about something strongly and we come to the conclusion that this is really the path we need to take. Can we say we really emotionally powered up? No, but at least in our mind we're towards it. Okay. So that's another way of doing it, right? In other words, there's no simple way of the Nefesh Elokis winning the Nefesh Abamis. It's got to come through learning, which is the whole idea of Tanya. That's what Tanya was written for, for us to reflect and to contemplate and so on. Okay. Then he says from Perik Yud Ches, he says, how about if that doesn't work? Let's say you don't have such a depth of knowledge to be able to really, really, in your mind even, be fully there, right? So in Perek Yud Ches onwards, and this goes from Perek Yud Ches in the 18th chapter to the 25th chapter, which we're in the middle of now. We kind of stopped in the middle last year. He starts a new method, and that is to explain the Ahava Mesuteres, the hidden love that every Jew has. Every Jew has. And explain at length, and we went through this at length, about how it's inherited from Avraham Avinu, and so on and so forth. What is that hidden love? The hidden love is, it's a love that every Jew intrinsically, right? We all can't say that we have it consciously, which is really what we're trying to explain to us, how we do it consciously. But we don't have to develop a new love. We actually have an Avo Meseteres. We have a hidden love for Hashem, which he calls later the Chochma of the Nefesh, right? Similar to what we normally refer to as the Pintaliyid, let's say, okay? Which is really the point of connection that every and there's so many different levels of neshamas, and our levels of neshamas nowadays is very low level. Perhaps he talks about the, depending on where you come from in the evolution of the spiritual worlds, like Bri, Yetzir, Asir, and in Asir itself, like there's Sphiris, and in Sphiris itself there's Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama. So most of our neshamas will probably come from the Nefesh of Malchus of Asir, which is like the lowest, right? But it doesn't matter, because we're all connected, it's a chain. And all the neshamas, even though consciously they might be at that lower level, but through a chain process, we're all connected all the way up to what he calls Chochmah Yiloh, which is the Chochmah of Atzilus, which in plain language is the point of complete nullification, surrender, and bittul and connection to Hashem. Right? Which is why the neshamah is called Neir Hashem Nishmas Adam, and the neshamah is called a candle. Why? Right? I hope you don't mind me summarizing it. Yeah, it's good, yeah? So because just like a candle, interesting thing, he says, a famous part of Tanya, who explains the real bittul of the neshama, right? What is a candle? A candle, fire always goes upwards. Why does oil go up? It's because the fire in this world comes from the what we call the foundational fire of the world, which is the source of fire. And a candle is less physical, less material, less tangible. It's more spiritual. And therefore, a candle of fire actually is flickering upwards because it doesn't want to stay down here. A candle wants to actually rejoin and reconnect with its original source, become part of the original fire, right? Even though the candle knows that the fire knows, so to speak, right? That if that were to happen, the candle as it exists as an independent entity will cease to exist. It will become part of a bigger reality. But that's what the fire wants. It doesn't want to be independent. It wants to be part of the bigger reality. So too the neshama. Every one of our neshamas, at its very foundation, just wants to be part of Hashem's reality. It wants to become completely bottled, right? Okay, Hashem doesn't want us to become completely bottled in that way. Hashem wants us to live in this world of the Torah mitzvahs. Okay. But where does it express itself? So he says, it expresses itself in the concept of Mesiras Nefesh, right? What does that mean? Self-sacrifice. Well, we found throughout the ages that even Jews who were called Kal Shebekalim, which means even people who didn't necessarily keep all the mitzvahs, didn't necessarily weren't that connected to Hashem, right? But nevertheless, when faced with a challenge of either converting, in other words, serving Avodah Zarah, serving idol worship, right? Or giving up their life, they chose giving up their life, right? Which really is not understandable. If you're so connected, so then why yesterday you didn't do mitzvahs? Why you, like, all of a sudden now? What's the pshat? Pshat's like this. Because when it comes to Avodah Zarah, when it comes to idol worship, let's say, as an example, there's no wiggle room. In other words, everyone knows if you serve idol Avodah Zarah, you're disconnecting from Hashem. And a yid intrinsically can't become disconnected from Hashem. Right? Just not who we are. Unless that spark of the neshama is so hidden that Samam is trapped and therefore they were yidden that did serve Avodah Zarah. Okay, but why do we find we still need to explain about the yidden that didn't on a day-to-day conscious level weren't so connected, and yet when it came to Avodah Zarah, they were ready to jump in the fire. Why? Because what happens is that when a yid is faced with a situation where he or she knows that the step that they're going to take is a blatant denial of Hashem's existence, and therefore an obvious disconnection from Hashem, what happens then, that challenge ignites the Ahavo Mesoteres, the hidden love. And that hidden love, once it's revealed, it can't do anything wrong. And therefore, jump in the fire. What happened yesterday, the day before, and the week before? That Ahavo Mesoteres, that love was hidden. That's the pshat. It wasn't conscious. It was hidden, right? But it's there. And where does it come out? How do we know it's there? Because it manifests itself, it comes out in this challenge of Avodah Zarah. And when that happens, the yid is ready to give him a serious nefesh, ready to give up the life. If there's terms I use you don't understand, stop me, okay? Because Now, so therefore, what does the Alter Rebbe say? What does he want to do in this chapter 18 to 25? He wants to say, he's going to tell us that really we can access that hidden love with regard to the whole Torah mitzvahs. If we understand, this is the punchline which we have to get to at the end of the cafe, if we understand that really every mitzvah is connecting to Hashem, and every absence of mitzvah, every avodah, really like avodah zarah, subtly. Right? If we understood that, then we make the connection. Not just understood that, but if we internalize that, then we'd be in control. We'd make that choice of Mesiras Nefesh on a day-to-day basis, which wouldn't necessarily mean giving up our life. It would just mean being uncomfortable. It would be going against that temptation of the Nefesh HaBamis. Yeah? You look confused.
So the transgression will cut the connection.
Not like a Avodah Zarah completely. Like we says, the Friedrich Rebbe says in Bas Ligani, it's like a rope which has 613 strands. And some of it just a sever a strand, but it still weakens the connection.
Okay, so that's a transgression. That's transgressing and prohibited.
Or anything that's unholy or ungodly.
That's what I was going to say. Anything that's unholy, so eating to excess. It's also.
Again, remember, you have to be careful. We talk about these, right? We've mentioned many, many, many times. I wanted to make it clear again. That obviously, everyone, the way we become an aspiring Bainani, so to speak, is everyone according to their own journey. It depends where they're holding, right? It would be unwise, for example, if someone, you know, wasn't up to the level and started saying, from now on, I'm only going to eat exactly what I need, only for the right intention, only serve Hashem, just not practical, right? But I mean, the mindset, we're talking about the mindset now. Yes, correct. So see, and that's the theory. Process, every time we do something, every time we're involved in something that's not godly, we'll see why as we move along here, is a disconnection from Hashem. And therefore, that's a way to ignite the hidden love, to not to want to do it. In other words, rather than going through the method of creating a new love of Hashem through hisbonenus and through reflection and meditation and so on, it's more about accessing the little hidden love that we already have, which is the source of Mesiris Nefesh. But you have to make the connection that every mitzvah is worth having Mesiris Nefesh for. That's the point. That's the real point, right? Okay. So in order to explain that, we learned Perek Chof and Perek Chof Aleph. Now, I'm not going to go summarize Perek Chof Aleph really properly because we spent a lot of time in it. But the point of it is like this. And we need to understand a little bit of Chof Aleph just to go understand Chof Beis. So the point of Chof and Chof Aleph was really to summarize and explain really the basis of Chassidus. The Mittler Rebbe says that the basis of Chassidus Chabad, yeah, how would you define the basis of Chassidus Chabad? No? What's the essence of Chassidus Chabad? Yeah, Dibur Torah is interesting. Yeah, Dibur Torah is a purpose of life. But getting to the... Yeah, okay, true. But actually, if you look really deep, it's obviously Dibur Torah, because that's the application, that's the avodah. Mittler Rebbe says that the base of Chassidus Chabad is Achdus Hashem, the oneness of Hashem. Meaning the oneness of Hashem, the way Chassidus understands the oneness of Hashem. Not that Hashem is the only God, and that he's one God as to exclude other gods. He's the only one reality, really. The second part of Tanya, the whole Shara Yichud V'Emuna, all 12 chapters, is for that explicitly, right?
So, you're saying that the Chassidus doesn't have that as their foundation?
Not so emphasized like Chassidus Chabad. It's based on other, it's based on the Baal Shem Tov. It's based on the Baal Shem Tov, yeah. Yeah, of course. The whole Chassidus is about looking at the essence of everything and but other forms of Chassidus don't dwell so much and so deeply on understanding this idea of the bittul of the world to Hashem, and that really, yeah, difference. Maybe one time we'll give a share on the difference between other Chassidus and Chassidus Chabad, because actually nowadays it's been misunderstood a bit and been confused. But they're actually radically different. Anyway, different, okay. Okay, but that's not for now. But anyway, so the point he made in chapter 21 and chapter 22, chapter 20 and 21 is this. He brought it out differently in 20 and 21. So in chapter 20, he basically explained that the world is so distant from the greatness of Hashem that it's kula kamekel achoshi. This world is considered completely insignificant to Hashem. And the analogy, just very briefly, was that... Take, for example, we know that Hashem created the world with speech, right? Now, obviously, the speech of Hashem is not like our speech, and we'll get to that soon. But just even with this imagery of speech, right? Take a personal human being. We know that sometimes when we look at ourselves, we get a bit of understanding of what we're trying to talk about when we talk about Hashem, right? So with our speech, what would a person say? Like, what's one speech? If I say a sentence now, right? How does that compare, for example, to everything that I could potentially say, to the power of speech, right? I mean, a person throughout their lives, I mean, certain people show this actuality, right? They can talk and talk and talk and talk forever. We can talk infinitely. A person lives 7 years, they can talk, in theory, the amount of words we can say in a lifetime is just infinite, right? So how would you compare that one sentence I say today in comparison to the power of speech? It's like nothing, right? It's like saying a little bit of a tiny speck of dirt on the carpet there, what's in regard to the whole building? It's like nothing, right? That's just in comparison to the power of speech. How does speech compare to the power of thought, which is much higher than speech? I'm going to go through it now. He went through it, that we did it inside. And then there's power of thought comparison to our emotions, by emotions compared to our power of intellect. if you go all these levels, that, then the one sentence I say is mamash nothing. It's like insignificant. It doesn't like hard. Yeah? Yeah? So Hashem created the world with speech. That's the world to Hashem. It's like nothing. Right? This whole big reality that we see in front of us that we think is so important and so powerful and so amazing is garnished. It's nothing. That's on the one hand. That's chapter 20 in 5 seconds. Chapter 21, right, he flipped it a bit and he said like this. But on the other hand, he said, it's not that it's nothing that is separate to Hashem. And this is what I'm going to just spend a few minutes explaining it again because we took a long break and I want to bring it in so we can understand the next chapter. We explain the following. And that is like this. That really, you can't really compare our speech anyways to Hashem's speech, right? Why? Because what is speech by a human being? Right? Speech by a human being is the power to go to communicate something outside of me, correct? In other words, when I think something, that's still within me, and you have no access to it. If I say it, now it's left me, correct? That's what Dibur is. I reveal it to you. What that normally entails is a tzimtzum. In other words, it's a concealment, because when you communicate something to someone else, it's nowhere nearly as intense as you think it with yourself, right? You can have a thought that's so intense that you understand the thought or you grasp the thought, but it'll take you an hour to say, correct? Like sometimes you have an amazing idea or an amazing feeling about something. It'll take you a long time to say it because you can't communicate it the way it's within you. It's not communicable to someone else, right? That's even between human beings I'm talking about, right? And therefore we have this power of speech. What's speech? Speech, what we call in Chassidus, a tzimtzum. It's a way of diluting it. I break it into sentences, into words, into, right? And because I've broken it down and I've diluted it and I've structured it and I've broken it into a million different components, I'm now able to get it beyond me to you. I don't mean me and you as a comparison, I mean anyone, right? When you speak like that, right? But once I speak it, it's sort of outside of me now, really. It's the whole idea of speech is the ability to communicate to an other. Right? So the difference between thought and speech, for example, is that thought is within me, or my emotions are within me. As soon as they come to speech, they've left me and they're now communicated to an other, right? With Hashem, you can't say that. Because there's nothing other than Hashem. See, it comes up with this, it's a very, very deep idea, but let me just go through it again because it's quite important to understand. To understand the rest. With Hashem, the concept of speech, why do we call it speech? Because it's the idea of tzimtzum, the idea of creating something that to us looks like something separate, right? This is the whole idea that Chassidus talks about tzimtzum shaloi kepshutai. Tzimtzum is not literal, meaning Hashem diluted his infinite power. He hid his essence, so to speak. He hid his infinite light, what we call the Or Ein Sof, which is where tzimtzum began, right? So let's just understand this again. So before tzimtzum, before the world was created, it says the Or Ein Sof, the infinite light of Hashem, filled all of existence, making no room for a world that would feel like an other, like something else besides Hashem, or that would be finite, or that would be physical or mundane, whatever the case is. So Hashem hid his light, right? Hid it so that he would create a world that feels like an independent existence, especially this world, right? This world, not just a creation other than Hashem, it's a creation that doesn't even feel the existence of Hashem. We don't even feel our source. Like the Friedrich speaks about Selegani, these years it talks a lot about that. Where you can have Paro, you can deny, like he goes back to Paro, the king of Egypt, who denied the whole existence of Hashem. Right? He said, I made the river. Yeah. And we know it's all created from Hashem, but nevertheless, that's what Hashem can hide himself. But, although what appears to be something on the outside, it's not really on the outside. What I mean, so I'll give you an example. Let's take the sun. Adele, it's okay that I'm going through this again?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Let's take the sun. And we might just make the summary today, I don't know, we'll see. But, because it's such an important foundation, this. Okay. So I'll give you an analogy like this. Take, because Chassidus talks a lot about mo'er and oir, which means the source of light and the light, yeah? So for example, the sun and its rays. So the sun is the source of light, it's the luminary. And oir, light, is the rays of the sun, right? Now the rays of the sun are just one of the great ideas of Chassidus coming up with this idea of oir, when you have light, the rays of the sun, for example, they carry within them the properties of the sun, but they're not the sun itself, right? Like for example, if you block the rays of the sun, does it make a difference to the sun? No, it's not going to make any difference if the sun is shining in our room or not shining, right? Because the rays are nothing, it's insignificant. Nevertheless, they reflect the sun and they come from the sun, yeah? So too, we say this every day in davening. Our world is the essence of Hashem's light is not revealed in this world, otherwise we wouldn't be able to exist as a separate entity. But it's like the rays of the sun, only a spark, something, just like that dibur we spoke before, that one word that is so insignificant, that's what's keeping the world alive. It's a godly power, but it's a very diluted godly power. Okay. But in Shara Yichud V'Emuna, later on, the Alter Rebbe explains like this, that really, really the world is completely one with Hashem's reality. That dibur, that speech that Hashem creates, actually, is like it looks like the ray of the sun that has left the sun, but actually what it is, it's like the ray of the sun in the sun. So, later on, let me explain. So later on he explains, right? Later on he explains that really, if the sun can give rays, if the rays can emanate from the sun, so it's a very deep thing, this, right? Not all the chapters are like this. So if the rays of the sun can shine sun, right? In other words, if there's rays coming out of the sun, you must say, says the Alter Rebbe, that there's rays within the sun. Yeah? Now, what does that mean? What does it mean? How can you have rays in the sun? In the sun, there's only sun. There's no rays of the sun. Right? So, the Rebbe once gave a moshel like this. That let's say someone comes to a rov, a dayan, a judge, and based it, right? Two, you remember this, Marshall? Yeah. Two litigants come, and they stand in front of a dayan. Okay. This one says, you owe me $100. One says, you don't owe me $100. I don't owe you $100. Whatever the case is, right? And you hear the case, and the judge is a beis din, and he knows the halacha, he knows the Shulchan Aruch, he knows the Torah. And he's judging the case, and he comes up and he says, This one is chayav, this one's potter, right? You owe him $100, your claim is not right, your claim is right, yeah. So the litigants are talking about $100, and the judge is talking about $100, right? But it's different $100. Why? For Reuven and Shimon that are standing in front of the judge, $100 is money. It's like real money. I gained $100, I'm richer. I lost $100, I'm poorer. Yeah? It's money. The one who's guilty, the one who's lost the case, he lost $100. The one who won the case, the chayav, the potter, it makes a difference. It's a big reality for them, right? What's the $100 for the rov when he says $100? What's the $100? Nothing. The chayav and the potter are the same thing. It's all part of the Shulchan Aruch. That's all it is. In other words, it's all part of the case. In other words, this is Hashem's will, this is Hashem's will, this is Hashem's will. It's all part of the one case. That the losing, the winning, that word that he says, you lost, you won, $100 paid, $100 lost, whatever the case is, they're not different. It's all part of one thing. It's part of the Torah. It's part of the Gemara that he used to judge the case. You know what I'm saying? $100? No, no. Let me try to think of a different way of saying it. There's a different lotion, I can't remember that. Maybe it works better, but
I think also you use the ocean, in which it's possible to extract a drop of water from the ocean.
Yeah, the problem is that analogy is not. Okay, you know, we can give that, like, yeah, okay. Yeah, but it's different. I don't want to use that because that can get complicated. Because that's not, it's not entirely accurate. Nor is this actually, but I'm saying that.
Even words like speech, once you speak it, it's still in you because those thoughts or where it comes from is speech.
But then it's thoughts, not speech. In other words, the words that leave you left you. That's the. Now, the rays of the sun that I've left.
But the idea that you, like, give out in a form of speech, that idea still is part
of
you.
Yeah, correct. The point I want to say, maybe you didn't get the terminology. So what I was trying to say is that the judge judging the case, right? To him, the winning $100, losing $100 is just a part of the case. It's not actually $100. It's very different. To him, it's all part of one case. It's the judgment. It's part of the judgment. Right? The judgment has a lot of things in it. Losing $100, winning $100, the reason. Every page of that case is one thing. It's all part of the judgment. It's not like this is $100 winning and this is richer, this is poorer. The rich, the poor, the $100, the losing, the winning, it's just part of one case. It's a different thing, right? So a similar idea, Alter Rebbe says that the rays, if they come from the sun, they've got to be in the sun. But when the rays are in the sun, they're not there as independent rays. They're there as part of the potential of the sun. In other words, you can't differentiate between them and the sun. You have to conclude, it's a difficult idea. You have to conclude that the rays are in the sun, but in the sun, you can't identify that, like, this is sun, this is rays. No such thing. Once you're in the sun, they're all there. Okay. Oh. Says the Alter Rebbe like this. When Hashem created the world, he used the rays, right? The rays to create the world, because that's why the rays are very diluted sun. To us, it looks like the rays out of the sun. But in fact, the rays are in the sun. What it looks like to us is that the world is created by the rays outside the sun, but actually, the whole world and all the rays is like it's like still part of the sun. In other words, really, there's only really one identity, one reality. It's all completely bottled to Hashem, and that's the idea of oneness of Hashem. The world doesn't have really independent reality. I mean, of course, the world exists, and Torah says it exists. So that's not an imagination, right? That's a separate issue, but it's a. Its existence is not independent, right? So therefore, he says that you have to understand that we talk about Hashem's dibur, Hashem's speech. It's very different to our speech. But our speech, once the words have left us, has left us. It's the rays out of the sun. With Hashem, when he creates us with speech, which is what makes the world insignificant, but actually, it hasn't really left the sun. To us, only it left the sun. In other words, the independence that we think the world looks like it has, that's nothing. That's silly. Right? Okay? Now. That's what he explains in if you look at the last few words, just before we start the next parak. You know, let's start from there actually. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines up from the end of the chapter. It's the last three lines of the page. Ach legabe HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he says, Ach legabe HaKadosh Baruch Hu ein shum tzimtzum v'hester v'helle master ma'im l'fonel. Nothing hides, even though Hashem employed a system called tzimtzum of concealment, but actually to Hashem, nothing is hidden. Kach ha-sheicha ka'ora, to him darkness and light is exactly the same. Darkness does not make it dark for you. Why? Because these garments and these tzimtzum, these concealments, they're not separate from it. It's like the tortoise who has a shell, which means like has a garment, but the garment is part of the tortoise. Understand? That's an interesting analogy also. So for example, you look at a person. People wear clothes, right? When they dress, you don't see them. Because the garment is something different to them. So to us, when Hashem employs all these layers of tzimtzum, it's like he's hiding himself under one garment, under two garments, under a billion garments, right? But to Hashem, those garments are part of him. It's like the tortoise whose shell is part of the tortoise. Or turtle, I don't know. one of these animals anyways, right? Therefore, to Hashem, everything is truly nothing. Not only because it's insignificant. It's in Perek, in chapter 20, talk about the insignificance of the world. So for example, let's give a mashal. So we said, no, because one speech compared to all the speech, compared to the thought, compared to the thing, is like nothing. So you can say it's like one speck of a building compared to the whole building. But at the end of the day, that doesn't explain the real insignificance of the world. Why? Because at the end of the day, that one speck still exists. You can say, compared to the building, it's much nothing, but it still exists. If you went with a microscope and you picked out that one speck and you put it on a table, it's something, it exists. It exists as a separate thing. Yeah, it goes a long way to show how nothing we are in terms of insignificance. But it doesn't mean that we're, you know, when it gets to chapter 21, it's much deeper. He's saying that one speck actually is not, it's deliberate speech, that's why it's so diluted, but it's like the rays in the sun, not the rays out of the sun, even though to us it's like the rays out of the sun. Okay. Now we start chapter 22. Let's make a start. Raki says, the only thing is, Perichot Beis, 22. That even though our speech and Hashem's speech now is totally different, because our speech is like the rays out of the sun, his speech is like the rays in the sun. It says, Raksha Torah, Dibra, Koloshim, and Adam. But of course, the Torah speaks, I never know how to pronounce this word, but anthropomorphically, I think is the word, right? V'nikra b'Torah, Dibura, Yishalmokim, Baruch Hu, B'Shem, Dibur Mamish. The Dibur of Hashem, the speech of Hashem in the Torah is still called speech. K'Dibur Yishalmokim, and it's described the way our speech is described. Why? Because it does have the same properties, it just doesn't work the same way. Because the way Hashem transmits His life force to keep alive and to sustain and create those things that are on a very low level like us, but tzimtzumim rabim v'atzumim, with great levels of tzimtzum, miminim miminim shoinim, with all different types, right? Liborois bohem bruim rabim, to create many creations. Minim, miminim, shoinim, so many different types of creations. Right? In other words, basically he's describing what it appears to us. In other words, he's employing this method to conceal, to conceal, to conceal, to conceal, to create all these different types of creations. And then he adds a line, he says like this. V'chol kach govru v'otzmu hatzimtzum. And the Hashem made the tzimtzum, this concealment, so strong. The Hester Ponim Olyonim is such a concealment. What does he mean by that? What's this new line? Explain it like this. See, tzimtzum normally, let's say you have a very, very big teacher, a very, very big professor, and he's explaining something to a two-year-old, or a grade two-year-old, or a grade two student, right? So obviously he has to also use the process of tzimtzum, as we know, right? No, he's got to dilute it, he's got to bring it down, he's got to find something that the child can understand, right? If he explains the mathematics to the child, well, he understands the mathematics, nothing, he'll become completely bamboozled, right? So he's got also the same process, as Siddhas always give the analogy of a Rav and a Talmud, a teacher and a student. He's got to use the process of Tzimtzum. But there, it's not Tzimtzum like it is in this world. Because there, the Tzimtzum at the end of the day was for one purpose, the child should understand something, correct? At the end of the day, the child walks away and understood a mathematics lesson. Okay, the teacher had to go through a major tzimtzum process, but there was a gilui, there was a revelation there to the child, right? Hashem's tzimtzum is even stronger than that. He created such a tzimtzum that he's completely concealed, right? He created a world that denies his existence, right? That's the derivative tachtonim part, right? In other words, he created a tachton, such a low level of existence, there's nothing lower. Not only is it physical and mundane, you could have an existence that feels independent but still understands its connection to Hashem, at least on some level, like the higher worlds, like Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, Haruchni, you know, right? But to have an existence that of where there's total tzimtzum. Total tzimtzum means that Hashem appears completely concealed. That means govru atzimtzum, right?
That's the default
city? Of this world. As he says, "Achiyuchlu lehishavois," until it's possible to create ulehiborois and to keep alive or to create, keep alive and create gam devorim tmeim, even impure things The klipois, the sitra achra, to create klipa. Klipa means something that totally conceals Hashem, or sitra achra, which is the opposite of purity. Ulekabel chayusam, and how do they get their life force? How do they exist? Nothing can exist without Hashem, right? So how does an impure thing exist in the world? How does impurity exist in the world? How does tumma exist in the world? How does klipa exist in the world? Ulekabel chayusam v'kivim midvar Hashem. They've got to accept, they've got to receive their life from Hashem's speech. In a way that is very hidden and very low down on the rungs of levels, right? So that's a very intense tzimtzum. That's why it's called dibur. So in other words, Hashem still speaks in the language of dibur, even though that dibur is really part of him still. Because at the end of the day, he's in the darkness as much as he is in the light, right? Because nothing really conceals him. But to us at least, to us, those existences, those things that are created, are still getting their life force from Hashem, right? Because nothing exists without Hashem. So how can it be? How are they getting their life force from Hashem, and they have no connection to Hashem? They don't feel Hashem in any way. Yeah, you asked about the default. Yeah, the default of this world is like that, because even things that aren't impure is still klipa. Physicality is klipa, generally speaking, right? Because it's noiga could be, but it hides Hashem, right? This world is filled with that, at least. Especially after the sin of the fruit, the Etz Hadas, the fruit of the tree, right? And we live in a world where Hashem is totally hidden. We should, by the way, the world that Hashem chose to live in. That's what He wants us to do. He wants us to reveal Him. But we don't have that default either, right? Right? Our default is that we exist and everything else is abstract, right? We learn, and we believe, and we understand. We feel it? No, that's the point. But we have to try and feel it, and try and bring Hashem into the world, and become godly, and so on and forth. Right? You know, that's the whole, the Alter Rebbe says in the Kotei Torah, that's what Moideh Ani is, right? The word Moideh Ani means to thank Hashem, but it doesn't always mean to thank Hashem. It means also to surrender to Hashem, to agree with Hashem. What does that mean? He brings from a Mishnah, where there was an argument between two great Talmudic authorities, right? The group of men called Chachomim, and then Rav Meir. And then at one point they agree. So it says, in this particular area, Moidim Chachomim l'Rav Meir. The Chachomim submitted to Rav Meir. They said, okay, this aspect we agree with you, right? Says the Alter Rebbe, that's Moideh Ani. What's Pshat? Yid wakes up in the morning, right? After a whole night where our neshama has not been with us completely, because, you know, when you sleep, the neshama goes up and gets cleansed. So we're not very godly in the morning. Not just physically, like we comatose, but even spiritually. That's why we have to daven first thing in the morning, because that's what spiritualizes us, right? So wake up in the morning, not particularly godly. What happens? We wake up in the morning with a conflict between us and Hashem. What's the conflict? The way he puts it is very interesting. So he says like this, that from Hashem's perspective, he calls it lemaylo yesh lemata ayin, which means what exists above in the higher worlds, that's true. That's the true existence. What exists here is not the true existence. That's why it calls it lemaylo yesh. What's above exists properly, and what's down here, ayin, is like nothing, right? We wake up, it's different. What's real to us? The table is real. The breakfast that we're going to eat, the coffee that we need, right? That's yesh. What's Hashem? It's a concept. It's a, you know, we learned it in school. Right? So we learned the Torah, we learned chitas, whatever. It's like an idea. But it's ayin. It's like nothing. And we don't grasp it, right? So that's why we start in the morning, we say, Moideh Ani. We're going to submit to you. We're going to spend the day trying to come around to your perspective. Right? That's the avoid of Yid. We're going to spend the day coming around to where Hashem looks at it, not the way we look at it. Yeah. How did I get into that? Because, yeah, that's the default of this world, correct? Right? That's what we have to learn, and we have to switch our perspective. Okay, now the next part is where we're going to leave it, but we'll just give a bit of introduction. He starts to talk about, therefore, the relationship that Hashem has with things that are holy and things that are klipa. Right? Because in Kabbalah we learn, you know, in the Torah we have this thing, for example, in the second one of the, this is this week's parasha, right? Where it talks about not serving idols, right? So it says you shouldn't serve Elohim Acherim, other gods, right? But in Kabbalah it says that the word Elohim Acherim doesn't only refer to other gods. It refers generally to the forces of Klippa, right? Meaning, things that conceal Hashem in the world. Forces that conceal Hashem. Even if they have some holiness in them, even if they, like, because Hashem, we know when he created the world, he also created what we call the powers of Klippa, which the Alter Rebbe says elsewhere in Tanya, sometimes do understand their source. They understand that's called Korula Elokod Elokai, like the way Avodah Zarah originated, that they understood that Hashem is the boss, but he's the God of gods, so to speak, right? He's distant. Yeah. In other words, anything that any force that conceals Hashem in the world, even if it's not completely defiant against Hashem, is called Elokim Acher. And he's going to explain next, when we learn next week properly, but he's going to explain. I'll give the mashal now, so we get a bit of introduction to this, so we'll be more familiar with the concepts next week. Hashem's relationship and Hashem's revelation to different things in the world. So again, in truth, everything is completely part of Hashem's reality, but in terms of how we view it, in terms of consciousness, in terms of how the relationship works, right? So we're going to learn about it like this. When a person has a desire for something, right? So it doesn't actually spell it out this way over here, but it's explained in the Mefarshim. There's three levels of desire. There's three levels of Ratzon, right? We call Pnimius HaRatzon, like the true essential desire that I have. Chitzonius HaRatzon, like secondary, like external superficial desire. And then there's Achurayim HaRatzon, which means almost like a foreign Ratzon. What does that mean? But I'll give you an example. A person does a job. You got a job? He works in an office, right? Why does he work in an office? Because he wants to support himself and his family. Yeah? So what does he really want to do? Support his wife and family. Let me see him as that. It's 47, right? In other words, what's his pnimius haratzon? What's his real desire? Where is his heart and soul? To bring back money for his family. To keep his family alive, right? So then what's the job he's doing in the office called? Chitzonius HaRatzon. Which means he might even enjoy it, and it might be going well, and it's good, and all that kind of stuff, right? But that's not, it's still a kashtikal means to an end, right? So he's dedicated, he does it properly, he has a good time, he enjoys it even, he's accomplished, successful. That's not, I mean, unless it is, which is a problem, but his That's superficial Ratzon. That's a secondary Ratzon, right? Then you have things that are even worse than that. Chitzonius Ratzon. Chitzonius Ratzon means, Achorayim Ratzon. Let's say, I don't know if paying taxes is a good example, but maybe it is, like, who wants to pay taxes, right? So why do you pay taxes? Well, let's say worse than that. Let's say you have to give something, a present to someone you actually hate. Why? Because I don't know. It's a neighbor of yours. He's driving you crazy. So you only want to give him a present. They should calm down. I don't know, whatever it is, right? You don't like the person. You can't stand the person. The person's annoying. But for some reason, it's important to give him something, right? You want to give him something? No. Do you enjoy giving him something? No. Or you're annoyed that you have to give him something? Almost, right? Yes, yeah, like... And you still have a will to do it. Why? Because you want to do it because it has a purpose. Right? It has a purpose. So why I'm bringing this in is what we're going to learn next week. I'm going to have to stop soon. But what we'll learn this week is that we understand this idea of tzimtzum and concealment of Hashem and the creation of klippa, of impurity, understands Hashem's different relationships to different things in the world. How even though Hashem relates to everything in the world, because nothing can exist without Him, and everything ultimately is a part of Him, but even the way it seems to us that it's like the rays out of the sun, everything still depends on Him, right? But His relationship with those things are different depending on the thing. And we'll learn that the relationship that Hashem has, so to speak, with Klippa, with things that completely conceal Hashem, and the impurity and things that are against His will, He wants them to exist, obviously, otherwise He wouldn't create them. Obviously, he wants him to exist because he wants us to have free choice. He wants us to live in a place of struggle. That's the point of creation, to overcome the struggle. If they didn't exist, then we wouldn't have a struggle, right? So therefore, he wants it to struggle. He wants us to struggle because that's the whole point of connecting to Hashem in a stronger way. Therefore, they need to exist so we can make that choice. But that's not his real Ratzon. His real Ratzon is Kedusha, right? And when we understand the way different ways Hashem relates to different things, we'll understand what happens in terms of our energy and our relationship to Hashem when we engage in those things that are not primus or Ratzon of Hashem. But that's going to be a long thing, but that's the point where we're going to go to. That all leads up to the final thing in Perek Chof Hei. Okay, we'll stop today and to be continued. Oops. Welcome.